Hey guys, and welcome to episode 233 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interview Dr. Lauren Wadsworth. And in this episode, I chat with Lauren about paedophile-themed OCD, or POCD for short. We talk about some of the types of obsessions and compulsions that go along with this theme of OCD. We talk about the groinal response, intrusive images, exposure and response prevention for this theme, mental compulsions, shame, how it can affect people's sex lives, how families can support their loved ones with this particular theme, words of wisdom for living with uncertainty, and much, much more. So Lauren goes into a lot of depth. I really appreciate it. And if you're affected by this theme or you know someone who is, I deeply hope it helps you. And a quick shout out to our podcast partners, NoCD. NoCD Therapy matches you with a licensed therapist trained to treat OCD, offers a personalized treatment plan, delivered through face-to-face video therapy sessions. Between therapy sessions, you can use their therapeutic tools in the app 24/7, message your therapist, and learn what helps other people in their OCD peer community. To find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. So thank you to NoCD for supporting the work I do. And without further ado, here is Dr. Lauren Wadsworth. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Lauren Wadsworth. Lauren is a licensed clinical psychologist specializing in treating people with OCD and related disorders. Welcome to the podcast, Lauren.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's good to have you here. And I'm always interested when I get clinicians or therapists on to find out why they got into being a therapist and then why they got into treating OCD.
Yeah, well, I'll try to make the story brief because it's a bit of an adventure. But in undergrad at Smith College, I was really lucky to have, I don't know if you know Randy Frost, he's a clinical psychologist that specializes in OCD and hoarding as a professor. And so he did this class on hoarding disorder, and I was just totally intrigued by that and OCD and asked if there was any way I could have some experience working with clients, like volunteering to do CBT or exposure therapy in home. And he said, yes, there are tons of people that could use free help. So together over the course of 2 years, we created a program where I would train undergrads to do exposure therapy in the homes of people with hoarding disorder to help them get rid of things and, you know, create more space in their homes. And what I noticed just from a personal level was, you know, being full-time college student and working, I think, like 30 hours a week of other jobs, I remember sometimes going into the sessions being like, oh, this is the last thing I want to do. I'm tired. I want to work on my homework. The last thing I want to do is go into a dusty home. And I remember every time I left, I would just be so hyped up and inspired and like at the brink of tears at what strength I had seen. And just like buzzing with energy. So I thought that was a pretty good sign that this might be my path. Throughout graduate school and between undergrad and graduate, I did a few other types of research, but kept coming back to OCD as the thing that I was most passionate about, and was lucky enough to train at the OCD Institute for part of my internship and then all of my postdoc year. At McLean, which was really, really awesome and just like sealed the deal for me.
Yeah, no, that is awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And McLean's obviously a great place to train. With your hoarding days, not you personally, but when you're working with people who hoard, how often did you see sort of classical OCD in those people, whether that was intrusive thoughts or, you know, other themes?
So I think, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, and Randy's going to kill me if he hears this, but the co-occurrence rate is pretty high. And I don't remember back then hearing about intrusive thoughts. It was more of completeness and perfectionism that I would retrospectively say I noticed. And back then they were considered within the same, you know, diagnostic criteria. So the repetitive behavior was seen as compulsive. So it was described very much as the same as OCD. But in retrospect, I would say it was more of the completeness, the high of collecting something, And then the shame afterwards and the guilt by not having been able to get rid of it that reminded me of OCD.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. Okay, so today we got you on to talk about paedophile OCD. Let's start basic. What is paedophile OCD?
Paedophile OCD, or POCD, some people refer to it as, is basically obsessions worried about being a pedophile, or fear of being a pedophile without knowing it or without having certainty that you aren't. And involves just a torturous onslaught of intrusive images, questions, and then related rituals, which we can get into all the details. But in a nutshell, it's a fear of being a pedophile.
Yeah. And is this, how often would you say you see this? I know you can't give like hard statistics, but roughly how sort of common or uncommon is this in your practice?
So it's interesting because before opening the clinic in Rochester, where I am now, it wasn't as common in the residential and the partial settings that I was working in. But we have a really high occurrence at my clinic, and I'm not sure why it is. I'd say it's about 20 to 23% of our patients with OCD have pedophile OCD.
Yeah. Wow. So it's quite high. And I guess it's reassuring in the sense that if you're someone with this theme, I'm sure because it's so taboo, it can feel like you're the only one. But hearing you say actually 20% of the clients or patients you see have this theme, it's quite striking.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's because we're the first, OCD labeled clinic in the area. People are feeling more comfortable coming forward, whereas other types of subsets of OCD folks might have been seeking treatment from providers that have it listed as something they do, but maybe not their main specialty. Many patients that have been in treatment weekly for 3 to 7 years before coming to see us and not having any relief.
And how have you seen, I'm not sure how long you've been doing your private practice, maybe you could share that, but have you seen it increase at all, or is it just stable?
So stable, I mean, it's been a very short amount of time. So I left McLean last summer and came back to my home area of Rochester, New York, because of the huge lack of resources here. And just within a week, we were full, and now we're up to 9 clinicians. And we have a 2-3 month wait list with many people with intrusive thoughts being one of the big ones. So it's just been a massive explosion. But I haven't seen an increase. It was just a really high number from the start. But I've been thinking about putting more psychoeducation on our website, which I think will bring a massive influx, which I've kind of been holding off for a little bit. But yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. I'm still not quite sure why we have such a high rate.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. And I think I asked that question because through various sources, what I'm kind of establishing or predicting is that it has increased in recent years. And I don't know if that's increased because more things in the media have triggered this theme, or OCD to latch onto this theme, or whether in fact it hasn't increased, the numbers were always there, but because there's more OCD awareness, people are coming forward more with these worries and concerns, which is why it looks like there's more of this theme.
Or I think those are all awesome theories. I also wonder if it could be that because the awareness of OCD in general is becoming increased, and a lot of the subtypes are talked about more regularly than POCD, maybe this is a way for OCD to latch onto something that feels unforgivable and secret and taboo and not common, so is maybe latching on a little bit heavier in folks as other subtypes are becoming more exposed in the media.
Yeah, I've never thought about it like that. I mean, that's a really interesting theory. Thank you for that. And let's get into the detail. Someone with this theme, what are some of the obsessions that would come along with this, or that you've heard and seen?
Yeah, so I've noticed anecdotally a pattern of obsessions over time. So typically when people come to therapy the first time, I've noticed people saying, I'm having a lot of thoughts that I might be a pedophile. I'm seeing a kid in the grocery store and asking, am I attracted to them? I'm trying to figure out, when did these thoughts start? And I'm trying to not go into the rituals yet, but am I attracted to my children? Have I always been attracted to my children? Am I going to do something? Am I going to lose control and molest them? Should I not bathe them, et cetera? And then once we kind of do psychoed on pedophile OCD, I've noticed that people have an initial boost where they start to feel a lot better. And that can wax and wane, just like any type of OCD. But once we get some headway there, it tends to jump to obsessions about the past and about jail. So some of the most common ones being, okay, I might not be afraid of acting on my thoughts now, but did I in the past? Did I buy a drink for a kid at a bar that was underage? Did I hit on someone that was 14 when I was 16? I remember when I was 8 getting undressed with a friend of mine and drawing each other. Was I a pedophile then? And then going through this mental rehearsal of reviewing all of the memories. So those two. And then the jail one is another big one. So am I going to jail? When am I going to jail? I'm sure they're going to knock on my door at any time. And then all these questions of, should I exercise now so that I'm fit for jail, so that I can protect myself? Or should I enjoy my life now because jail's coming and I can exercise all I want in jail?
Mm-hmm.
And then a fourth that seems to be one of the most lingering, if I'm a terrible person because I have these thoughts, do I deserve to be happy?
Yeah. Thank you for breaking it down like that. I'm laughing because definitely one of those thoughts I've had before. I guess to me, when you were saying that, especially the bit about, and I'm losing my train of thought, where you were kind of reflecting back on the past, some of that reminded me of kind of false memory OCD and also real event OCD, when you talked about when I was a kid and I was around another kid's house, and kind of overlaying and mentally reviewing that for unethical behavior.
Mm-hmm. And how it gets so much less certain the more you're looking at it, right? Yeah. So the more you're asking and replaying the memory, the fuzzier it gets and the more room there is for OCD to say, oh, I think you actually were enjoying the fact that they were a child, or you were hoping they were underage, or, and then you can't go back and look at the tape, right? So it's just so incredibly insidious.
Yeah, very, very good point. And then on the flip side, what are some of the compulsions that you've seen people do to kind of avoid these thoughts?
I think that the compulsions are the piece of POCD that make it in some ways pretty unique from other types of OCD and especially torturous. So specifically thinking about the groinal response at the moment, that's one of the biggest pieces with sexual intrusive thoughts that I find fascinating in it's extremely painful kind of way. So I could break that down.
Yeah,
if
please.
That would be appropriate. So basically we could imagine that POCD originates by having a looking at a child. Say you're walking down the grocery store and you see a child and you might have a thought of, oh, I hope I'm not a pedophile, or I hope I'm not attracted to children. Or you might think, that's a cute kid. And then why did I think that kid was cute? You know, am I sick? And then with POCD, it's in sexual intrusive thoughts, it's so torturous because we look for evidence, right? With any type of OCD, there's a search for evidence. And one great way to look for evidence, quote unquote, is to check if you're physically aroused. So a person will say, I don't know, am I attracted to children? Let me check my genital region. Do I feel anything there? Is there a tingling? Is there warmth? Is there movement? And the torturous thing is that if you pay attention to a body part, you're going to feel something, right? Like everyone right now could imagine just think about your right hand. Do I feel anything in my right hand? I feel my finger kind of quavering. What does that mean, right? You create sensations or just notice that our bodies are full of sensations all the time. specifically with genitals, I mean, just thinking about anything to do with sex or sexuality or penises or vaginas creates sensations because we're evolved to think that way, right, as humans and animals. So it becomes this torturous cycle where the person checks, do I feel aroused? Any of us will feel a sensation if we ask that question. And then that feedback loop gets faster and faster and faster, so that after doing this check 50 times, right, and let me think about a kid to see if I get aroused, to check if I'm a pedophile, it'll happen faster and faster, so much so that suddenly you're scrolling through Instagram, it's a picture of a child comes up and you're already, feeling arousal sensations. So they become so linked that it feels undoubtable. And that's so hard to talk about. So that obsession, that ritual of checking is one of the things that makes the cycle so torturous. It feels like increasing evidence over time. And it feels like something you can't argue against.
Yeah, because it's a bodily sensation. Yeah, and I think for that, and yeah, anyone who's done meditation, usually the mindfulness teacher, whether it's through an app or in person, will say whether you they'll often do body scans, and they get you to notice, as you said, what's your left hand feel like now, or what does your thigh or your stomach, or and you realize that your body, there's so many physical feelings in your body at all times, but we're not paying attention to them. So yeah, when your mind then focuses in on said part of the body, in case with OCD, well, why am I feeling this now? Well, there's always something there, you just weren't aware of it. Yeah.
Exactly. Other rituals include things like reviewing memories, which we already talked about. So mental review, increased doubt, decreasing pleasurable events in life is a big one. I mentioned this before, but I don't deserve to have a happy life. So this might look like not scheduling dates with your partner, not having close connection with your partner or friends, because A, I don't deserve it. B, I might go to jail, so why get closer to them before I'm about to leave? So basically, shutting down of the life, both in a self-penance, let me punish myself for being a pedophile, and I don't deserve it anyways, and then prepping for jail. Avoidance behaviors, not touching your children, not bathing them, not being alone in a room with them. You can imagine the stress that would have on a partner that's, co-parenting with you if they have to be there all the time. Not changing diapers, not looking at their kids naked, avoiding kids altogether in the grocery store, not going near children, for fear of acting on these thoughts.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. And I can imagine where people start to decrease the quality of life, the things they do that bring joy to them. That's just a quick route to depression as well.
Exactly. And POCD, I just noticed such a huge rate of shame and guilt and this just egodystonic thoughts of, I'm a terrible person when all I want is to protect children. Like, these are people that would be the safest people for children to be around because they're so scared to do something, so terrified of children that they'd be the last person to hurt a child. But the fact that they have that love and that care and they simultaneously think they're a monster, it just leads to feeling like not only am I a monster, but I don't even know myself. So that leads to tons of depression and shame and guilt and isolation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have a couple of questions on shame and guilt and disgust later on. And one thing, whenever I talk about obsessions, I often talk about them in the sense of thoughts and like the what ifs and the did I. How often do your clients talk about it in terms of like images that kind of come into their head?
A lot. I think that the images, so another ritual that we notice a lot is wincing or shaking of the head or covering your genital regions or trying to cause pain or sensations in other parts of your body to distract from genital sensations. And those are the ones we normally see around images. So typically, I remember I had a first session with a younger kid, a teen at that was experiencing POCD. And I said, all right, so let's come up with some examples for exposure. If I was to say like the word sex, how hard would that be, you know, for us to say that back and forth? And he almost ran out of the room. He was ritualizing nonstop before that, but just kind of lost control, shaking, pushing, you know, hitting himself. And he just, you know, it was a huge rupture in our alliance because I didn't realize I was going to be triggering him like that without his consent of doing the exposure, you know. So the images are they're awful. You know, you say the word sex and you're seeing an image of a child giving oral sex, you know, and then imagining that on your own body. And do I want that? And it's just horrific images, like the worst images you could imagine.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that story. Okay, so you started to mention there, but what some of the we'll kind of break it down. So some of the exposures you would do with this theme, and then some of the ritual prevention or response prevention that you'd encourage.
Yeah. I think this is one of the other things that's unique about POCD in terms of a therapist perspective. I noticed that in a lot of trainings, when I mention the topic, people kind of cringe and they get really uncomfortable imagining being the therapist with someone with POCD. And we really have to ask people to check that and work on that before matching them with a patient, because it is so, the work is pretty uncomfortable. It's very strange, and I'm happy to explain some examples. But I will just say, I think it's a tough one for many therapists to imagine doing. And I haven't had that experience yet, but I have had moments in ERP where I've thought, am I crossing a line now? So what we do is we start out with a lot of just triggering words. So saying the word sex or pedophile or child molester, back and forth. Sometimes I like to add humor in, so we'll toss a ball back and forth, saying it in different voices or tones. Kind of mess with the schema associated with the word to increase cognitive flexibility. We'll do scripts, so increasing intensity, starting with I might be a child molester to I'm probably a child molester, or I've probably molested tons of children. I'm definitely going to jail, playing out jail narratives. I'll get strangled there. I'll die in jail. I'll lose everyone that loves me. Even if I get out of jail, they'll be so disgusted by me because I'm a child molester. Sometimes narratives include people's children, and this is where, you know, I wonder where the line is. You know, we write stories about changing a daughter, or you know, giving her son a bath and having sensations of arousal, and definitely being a pedophile. So they can get pretty intense. Sometimes I'll do exposures where I'll have two people with POCD talk to each other over video platforms. So it's going over the internet, searching things on their phone's internet, starting out with searching things on my computer, which has the most messed up search history you can imagine. And then, you know, talking about how, oh, my schedule is in my computer, so they could link this search to your appointment time and you'd go to jail for it. Really just using the person's OCD to come up with a script, because it's pretty creative that way. And then in terms of ritual prevention, we'll do a lot of avoiding avoidance. So start loving your kids, start hugging your kids, start walking closer to the kid in the grocery store, which again can sound pretty creepy when you're recommending it. It's such a taboo topic. You know, think about like on Halloween, you know, think about, oh, that girl in the princess dress is so cute and beautiful. You know, I'm sure she'll grow up to be a beautiful woman. We might, going back to exposures for a second, watch videos of kids playing at the beach or pictures. Ritual prevention, making sure that someone's not scrolling fast through social media. I think that's one of the biggest ones. So you see a child and you scroll, zip past it. Scheduling pleasurable events is a big ritual prevention. So saying yes to that date with the boyfriend, opening the birthday presents, you know, enjoying, trying to feel emotions of happiness, exposure to those. Not checking and researching, so not researching your past relationships and the age of the people, stopping the mental review, trying to shut down the genital checking, and using some body scans. I like to do a lot of mindfulness, like I'm noticing arousal and I'm noticing my right foot hurts, just kind of folding it into the expanded awareness.
Yeah. No, thank you for that detailed list. And with the mental reviewing, because that's a compulsion that I've seen many people ask, yeah, but how do I kind of reduce it? Because that's one you find you just kind of you don't even know you're doing it sometimes. It's one of those sneaky compulsions that just, especially because it's completely in your head. Yeah, what are some ways you'd work with one of your clients to catch that and maybe reduce it?
Yeah, so I think like with any type of mindfulness, we just want to notice when the mind has gone somewhere else, right? So labeling being the first step. All right, I'm mentally reviewing, or oh, I'm in the past again. I tend to lean pretty hard on mental rituals. I think they're, really important to target. So I tend to recommend people do the probably statement. Yep, probably molested kids as a child. And sometimes we use a little humor, like, yep, probably was the biggest pedophile in town. Didn't even know it. What a loser. Moving on. So, yep, probably that was an illegal activity that I engaged in. And what else? I am making lunch right now. So the probably skill and then the and what else are the big ones. They're really hard to do at first with these, immoral thoughts. And if the person can practice it enough or do enough exposure therapy, usually the probably skill gets a bit more accessible. But sometimes with people, I'll say a rule of if you start thinking about the past, throw your phone across the room. If they're doing a lot of checking rituals of their social media history, just throw the phone. Engage in something. I might ask people to have their partners help. So usually when someone's ritualizing, they might have glossed over eyes or kind of staring into the distance. So hey, if you notice me staring off or watching a jail show and I'm staring into the distance, snap your fingers, let's get engaged in something. Like let's go make a dessert together. So helping the person notice by using external supports.
Cool. No, thank you. That was great. Okay, so as we kind of alluded to earlier, when you said about potentially one of the reasons why this seems to be more prevalent than it was before is because maybe it doesn't get talked about. So OCD is like, this is where I can focus now because we can't talk about these other worries anymore or as much. Which to me signals that there's the shame around the secrecy can lead to shame and stuff around because it's not talked about, and when it's not talked about, the shame can exist. So what are some ways that you've helped your clients kind of open up in whatever context that is in a kind of safe way?
Yeah, I think first I just want to underline the shame piece and how it's so big. Like it's so hard with this type of OCD to have social support. I'll even say, is this something you could talk to your partner about? And a lot of people will say no, like we're trying hard enough to have sex and these images of my daughter keep popping up when we're trying. I can't tell my wife that I'm thinking about that. Like it's already tense enough. Or I can't tell my friends. I can tell them I have OCD, but I can't tell them I think I'm a pedophile, right? So and I kind of get that. Like I push pretty hard in exposure therapy, but I don't push people to tell others in their life about POCD because I do worry about the safety of my patients, in terms of being reported and then being so anxious. In some cases, I don't know how things would go. And it sounds like I'm catastrophizing, but some of them are teachers, some of them are daycare professionals. And if that information got into the wrong hands, it could be catastrophic. So I tend to, in this is the I think the one example kind of avoid disclosure with this topic, and instead try to find supports through other folks with OCD. So I'll recommend that folks come to, we have a couple different groups at the clinic. We have an exposure group and we have a support group. So I recommend people come. And I say, I'm not going to tell you if other people have POCD, but I do recommend you listen and engage in the group. And maybe over time, as an exposure, start to share more and more about your OCD. And so over time, they'll do exposures of eventually saying a lot about their POCD to other group members. And then we've also found that it's been really helpful to have a couple of our folks with POCD just talk for one session, maybe every couple months, to talk about the struggles they've been having, just to feel a little bit less lonely. You know, it's so taboo. It's even hard to talk about in an OCD group.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that's why I asked it because, yeah, I can see the difficulty in opening up around this theme more than some of the others. But yeah, yeah, I agree. Like you said, opening up where possible around others with OCD that get that it's OCD and this is just the thing it's kind of latched onto. And also, I guess the kind of beauties of the internet is you can create anonymous accounts and then go into if there's a Facebook support group or something like that. So then you're keeping your identity secret.
Yeah, I don't know if any of my folks with POCD would
Really?
do that because there's so much fear of the
That's
that
true.
would be a great exposure. We could definitely do that though. And then maybe eventually go, you know, check out a group under their own name.
Try it and let me know.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, so next questioner, and you did mention it there, but I can fully appreciate that the most OCD themes or just OCD generally and anxiety can affect people's sex lives. This theme in particular, as you said, you know, you gave the example of having sex with their partner and they were getting thoughts of their daughter, you know, which I'm sure anyone listening could appreciate how that can be disturbing. So, yeah, how have you worked with some of your clients to kind of help them get back to some normality in their sex life?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I get that it's torturous and really hard to be intimate with your partner, even just to think about initiating it, because you know that the thoughts are going to come on. I remember working with a teen that had a lot of sexual intrusive thoughts about a variety, every different type, and we kind of he had a mental ritual of putting everyone in bubbles so that they were safe from him touching them, you know, in his head. And so I said, let's just pop the bubbles and have a big orgy tea party. Like, just let the thoughts in, you know, invite them along the way. They're already there, right? So, hey, like, you're here. All right. You can sit over there on the pillow, and I'm going to keep engaging with my wife. You know, it sounds weird, but it's just if you try to push them away or undo them, as you know, they just come screaming right back, even worse. So, saying the hey, you're here, acknowledging it as, you know, like a leaf on a stream, a mindfulness exercise, like, and letting it be in the room. Almost, and sometimes I like to say beat OCD to the punch. So when you're going into the bedroom, be like, hey, OCD, what do you got for me? All right, we're talking about this, and that, images. All right, let's put them on posters in the room and keep moving. Doing body scans. Yes, I'm noticing this image, and I'm noticing that I can feel my partner's body or her skin on my skin, and that feels nice. And there's another image, of course. What's new and what else, right? So trying to engage in eye contact when you're zoning out. But it's a really, really tough one.
No, thank you for sharing that. And I guess also just small steps and give it time, I guess.
Yeah. Another homework is, you know, asking someone to watch porn and, you know, think about and be, you know, sexual on their own time. That's a big exposure because there could be an underage person in the video. So you can kind of work through a bunch of it on your own in exposure before working up to the stuff with your partner. But I do think it helps to talk to your partner about it if you can, even if it's general. Like, I have horrific images pop in when we're having sex. So if you notice me zoning out, try to re-engage me. I don't want them to be there. This is why it's been tough. And then having them be a partner in it with you.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, it goes back to what we were saying earlier around opening up in a safe way. You can open up about OCD to a loved one, but you don't necessarily have to open up the theme. You could just say it's sexual intrusive thoughts. You don't have to go into the taboo nature of it if that's going to be acceptable to your loved ones. Yeah, okay. No, thank you for that. And this next question kind of is a follow-on, I guess, because you need to have sex to make the next thing happen, which is this theme can put well, actually technically with science you don't need to have sex anymore to make this happen, but I'm talking about having kids. But yeah, so this theme is obviously going to get in the way for some people. They may not want to have kids, because if you're worried about being a pedophile, then having a child is, I'm sure, incredibly triggering for some people. So when that comes up, yeah, what do you say? What do you do with these people to kind of, you know, help them live by their values, which is if they want a kid, help them have a kid, but not let OCD stop it?
Yeah, I think it's a huge, huge one. It's, I would call it a ritual, an avoidance behavior, because it's very common to have a thought of, I'm not going to have another kid if this is still going on, or I'm not going to start having kids at all if I'm experiencing this, or because I'm experiencing this. So what the first, you know, plan of attack I usually ask is, are you talking to your partner about this? Because oftentimes the person is kind of waffling out loud with their partner. And as you can imagine, without having OCD, but really wanting to have a kid, if your partner is just like 100% on and then 100% off, it's just can be really emotionally torturous for someone. So I usually recommend just to have a goal of taking that off the table in terms of a conversation to have with your partner for a few months while we have a chance to work on this, because it's not fair to them to go through that and prepping and then not prepping. So don't talk about it for a while. Let's just see where things land. And then using it as, you know, part of the ACT value driven reason to do ERP. So I might want to have a family someday, so this is really worth leaning into for a few months of really hard work for the chance of seeing if I have that potential. You could connect to it at some point. That means there's a chance that spark and that interest is there. Let's not question it or doubt it or challenge it too much, but just let it be a motivation to try this. Typically, I've seen that people within about 5 or 6 months of treatment can start to want to have kids again and have that joy of imagining having kids. So there's definitely hope, and it can feel like it's never going to happen. I'm never going to let that happen. I'm never going to put a kid in danger by even having one. But I do think there's a lot of hope, and that can change in a few months of ERP.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you for that. And the words of hope. Yeah, it's worth me adding actually as well. I have seen other people say that they want kids, but they won't have kids because they worry OCD is going to get involved. And this isn't even to do with this theme. It could be a theme completely unattached to children. But yeah, so I guess that those that words kind of links to that anyway, of do the therapy and hopefully you'll get to a point where you won't see OCD as a reason to stop or to hold you back.
Yeah, like basically right now, the way that where you're at in the beginning of treatment is just there's no point in planning your life 6 months from now or 10 years from now, because if we do our job right together, you're going to be in a totally opposite place. So let's just wait till then to make plans.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, so I was getting metaphors coming to mind, but I won't share them.
Ooh, I love metaphors.
Well, metaphor, analogy, I get the two mixed up. But yeah, it's kind of like deciding pre-therapy, trying to determine what you the next 10 years of your life is like, deciding where to go when you've got the wrong map, you know. And at the end of therapy, you've been given a more accurate map, which now you can decide where to go because you know that the directions you lead will kind of take you there, as opposed to the OCD map, which may lead you down different rabbit holes.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah, or like choosing what to eat for dinner when they show you 10% of the menu and you don't even know, you know, what the other options are.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that one better. Okay, cool. So, where's my next question gone? Yeah, so, yeah, we've kind of discussed it may be tough because some families won't know because maybe the person hasn't shared. But in the case that the person has shared, how can families help their loved ones with this theme?
Yeah, I think family just read, I would just say, number one, go to iocdf.org, go to intrusivethoughts.org, Google this, you know, look at Chrissy Hodges' videos on YouTube, and just see that this is not something that your loved one made up. You don't have to be worried. It would makes a lot of sense to be anxious at first, but just get in there. You don't have OCD, so read it as many times as you need to, and it won't be a ritual. But you just, you know, can take that reassurance in and the assurance that this is something we know how to treat and that we can make a lot of change pretty quickly. In terms of behavioral things they can do, engage your partner in life. They're probably isolating, probably not leaving the house as much as they used to, probably avoiding interacting with children or their own children or family members. So try to find ways to ask them, how can I be part of your exposure plan? Can we build up two things? Is there something, maybe we could go on a walk together in a neighborhood where there might be children, and then in a few weeks we could go to a park together? Just be a behavioral activation, you know, buddy, I'd say. Find tasks that you can do that are fun, that you can laugh, that you can connect back to what your relationship was like, you know, back in before OCD was taking over. And then be really patient with the intimacy thing if it's a romantic partner. But what I've seen that's been so amazing is that I'd say about 50% of our patients do tell their family members that they have POCD, and that their family members didn't blink an eye. And I'm, you know, I totally acknowledge that other families would, and that's why we don't push people. But the ones that have, it's just been really cool to have the family members, the parents, the partners just say, all right, that's what we're dealing with. Okay. There's a treatment. Great. Let's do it. And that's just amazes me.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing. Okay. So, more general question now. So just words of advice or wisdom for living with uncertainty.
Ooh, I see. Speaking of metaphors, I always picture uncertainty like a bucking bronco, and at the end of like some wild western movie with an incredible sunset. And I just have this image of wanting the people I work with to jump on that bronco and just ride it out. Like, who knows what's going to happen, and how cool is that? You know, if you can't be certain, that means that you have a life to live. That means that surprises can happen. Bad things are going to happen. Amazing things are going to happen. And if you're trying to take every step with certainty, you're going to miss all that fun. So I guess I would see it as, you know, jumping into the pool, because you know it's going to be shocking at first. And the slower you go in, the worse it is. But yeah, then you're swimming, you know. So I think it's terrifying. I think even as a full-time OCD therapist, uncertainty is hard, and I get trapped in that stuck point too, but it can be such a beautiful thing when you're really living in life fully.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Thank you for sharing. Very visual. So next question is just words of hope for people with this theme.
Yeah, I asked a couple of our patients, many of our patients, if they'd be willing to share thoughts for others with OCD, with POCD. And they had a lot of amazing things to say, both in person and also in text. And some said, I asked them what they would like someone with POCD to know. And many of the points and themes were that this is incredibly painful, that saying painful doesn't do it justice, that you're not alone in this. This is going to sound like reassurance, probably is, but your thoughts aren't your actions. We all have terrible thoughts that pass our heads, and really you can let them go. There is treatment for this. The treatment works. It means, I always think of it as going into hell for the chance of getting out. You have to go a little bit deeper, and you don't know if the door is going to be there, but the evidence says that 80% of people get better, so you can too. And I would say go to a trusted ERP therapist because they're going to be willing to lean in to the level that you need to get better.
Yeah. Love it. Thank you for sharing. And then slight change of direction. You can pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Lauren. What'd you tell her?
Oh, my God. Wow. Where was I at 20? I would probably say stop doubting yourself and just... similar to the Bronco thing, like just do it, just live your life, stop thinking that you're not intelligent. I grew up in a tiny town and I thought I was pretty stupid even past the time of getting my PhD, so it's still in there. But I would tell her, like, you're not dumb, you know enough to get by, and just trust your instincts and follow your heart and believe in yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you've got a billboard in Rochester. What do you want written on that billboard?
Well, Stuart, you've actually inspired me to think about this before. Good. So my goal is to get a billboard in Rochester. And I wanted to be just like a white billboard and then in big bold letters say, have OCD, need ERP, and then just our website or like the IOCDF website. Because moving back here, I've seen so many providers say they treat OCD and just have people stuck for 7 years. So it's been an adventure, but I just want people to know that ERP exists.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. And it reminds me of that Got Milk campaign.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably where the white background comes from.
Yeah.
Just totally ripping that off.
That's all good. It's for a good cause. No, that's great. And thank you for sharing that. And then lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have said today?
I guess I wish that I had said that OCD, no matter what subtype, is and can be extremely, extremely painful, and subtype doesn't matter. We always say in our groups, don't ever say, I wish I had your type of OCD. So I know I said a lot today about how POCD is unique or especially painful in some ways, but I believe that every type of OCD is equally painful in general. They just have their nuances.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah, the core of it is exactly the same, but yeah, they're painful in their own little different ways. Yeah, no, thank you for that, and thank you so much for sharing your wisdom today and the answers. Oh, I appreciate it, and I know the audience will too.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the opportunity. I know this is a taboo topic, so I really appreciate you using your platform to really spread the word and get some of those thoughts out there.
So there you have it. Thank you so much to Lauren for her time and to go into so much depth on this particular theme. And thank you to you guys, as always, for listening. I really, really appreciate it. And don't forget, today's episode is sponsored by NoCD. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.